I'd like to have you turn to the first page in the introduction, which is by this Robert Jelena. And note what he says at the very beginning of the introduction, the very first paragraph, why he calls us. Now he has collected these excerpts. The first paragraph indicates why he uses the term letters for this, letters to a post-Christian world. This is not the title that Dorothy Sayers had. They're just, it's, she's written a lot of, as he explains later in the introduction. How many of you read the introduction? It's really pretty good, because I think he does a good job on making her work a livable thing. I like what he says, for example, about who she was, the kind of person she was. Maybe one of you can, any of you remember what he says about her? I mean, that
she wasn't very pretty at all. She was almost like a man. She was bald.
Yeah, right.
But she was also, I think, essays attest from the most beautiful women.
I think this is a very good point, she was, as these essays attest, one of the most beautiful women of our century. And I think that this is a great thing to realize, that there is a beauty that is, and as I've said before up here, I think that one of the greatest things that the generations that have been coming up now have attested to is that people do not have to look like a Hollywood picture, either man or woman, to be a beautiful person. The term beautiful person has become a real statement about someone from the inside out. And that was never true when Alice and I were young, you know? And I mean, our idea of beauty was, you know, beauty queens and that sort of thing. And if you didn't look like that, just too bad for us. But that's not true now. And I think this is such a great, it's a leap forward. I don't think you realize what a leap. Anyway, she was large, raw-boned, and awkward, and had no neck at all. Her head appeared to be closely joined to the regions directly between her shoulder blades, and she wore eyeglasses which quivered. Her thinning hair rarely showed evidence of care or forethought in its total lack of rhythm. And then he said, well, hair, she was quite bald. But what else does he say about her? How about her education? I mean, is she a journalist? Right. She had degrees from the University of Oxford in England, and that's no joke. It's not like going to our universities. There's so much more involved in what they had to learn, and the classical education that she had was such that it was, you know, it really gave her the kind of body of knowledge out of which she could write not only terrific detective stories, but then she could also write these really great essays and books on theology, which is what she always wanted to do anyway. And since she made so much money on her detective stories, she could afford to write on these other things which didn't bring in so much money. Now she's got just, I don't know how much, it's a huge fund now that it just comes out of her detective stories, and they just keep on selling and selling and selling. And I would suggest that any time that you have some time to read something, do get one of her mysteries if you haven't read them, and even if you have, you could read them again, because they are well written. They're not only is the style good, but all the background is so well done. And for instance, if you read the Nine Tailors, it's just fabulous what she does with the ringing of bells in a country church, and how that produces a murder. And it's, and in fact, it was so good that she was asked to become vice president of the Bell Ringers Association in England. And that's a, it's so complicated to learn how to ring bells, I had no idea. Well, you could say, what difference does it make? Well, what difference does it make? Why learn anything? Just as well, you know, you could just as well sit and chew your cud. Whenever people ask me, you know, what difference does it make? And why should you learn about that? I say, yeah, well, why should you? I mean, why not stay home and just eat cookies? You know, you don't have to learn anything if you don't enjoy it. Okay. A little preaching is over. Hmm? Depends on what kind you like. I hate chocolate chips. look down at the bottom of page 13.
Page 13.
I mean, the Roman numeral 13. You'll probably be tempted by your habit of mind to ask, what does all this prove? It does not, in the scientific sense of the word, prove anything. The function of imaginative speech is not to prove, but to create, to discover new similarities and to arrange them to form new unities, to build new self-consistent worlds out of the universe of undifferentiated mind stuff. Now,
mind stuff?
Well, the stuff of the mind. What would that be? Cookies. Ideas. The things that are part of your mind, your imagination, your. I realize that, you know, he's a little slow, so we have to be paid. I have to explain things to him because he asks me questions like that. But
testing.
I don't feel like I need to be tested by you, so I don't worry about it. I just thought I should really help you out. But actually, the thing is that a lot of people do not realize that there is any need to think through things or to go over things or try to put things back together in another way. That's why when you mentioned yesterday, Kathy, about using the word imagination for a regenerated person, you know, why use that term? And you know, I said it really makes a difference to use a different term simply to make your own mind work around something and see it in a different way, but also for other people, for your communication of whatever you're talking about, and so that speech and ideas and thoughts don't just get to be monotonous, dull, sort of, you know, the way they get to be if nobody tries to think things through from an original source. The problem with a lot of people, I think, you don't realize how many cliches we use. I'm always biting my tongue over them myself, and I think you are too. And it's so true in terms of anything like religion or anything that has to do with the Christian faith. It's so quickly that we get into a jargon of words, and it's like the jargon that's in psychology or a science or a philosophy or what have you, the words that just happen to fit. And if you don't happen to be inside the group of people that know how that what those words mean, then it's just too bad for you. And that's why the Inklings, as I said when I talked about the imagination, why they make a difference, because they actually use words that are not the usual cliches for the terms that we understand. They use imaginative phrases, they use new images, they use whole new situations in order to produce a climate that can allow for a new approach and a new experience of what we know as Christian faith, and yet They may never call it that. And Dorothy Sears, in her writing, doesn't do that kind of thing. She's much more direct, but she's a salty and very clear writer, and also a person who does not allow you to just sort of go to sleep over the statements that she makes. You have to pull them apart. You have to be able to know what she's saying and ask yourself, now actually, what does this mean? The first section, what about, will you turn to that first section? That's sort of a, it was mostly just a kind of a, you know, called the, what is it, Selections from the Pantheon Papers. These were mostly written for Punch magazine, which is sort of like our New Yorker, only not as, it was much, had much more, in England, had mostly humor, and not just...
It's still being published?
Yeah, they're still, I think they still have it. They, I thought it went out of business, but I'm not sure if they were able to keep it going. There was a, I usually get a thing on a British magazine, but I haven't seen it lately, so I don't know. But she, this is the kind of thing that you can sort of, you know, do something a little bit extra. It's a little heavy for us. I mean, we're not, we don't know that much, so we really don't enjoy this kind of humor. That's the problem. We just haven't had the kind of education that allows us to really enjoy the humor that is in the kind of things she does here. The cosmic synthesis, for example. Blimey's monumental monstrosities of the Age of Unreason. And then she shows you the color plate. Now you look at it and see if you recognize some of the people there and what you think she's talking about.
Marx
you recognize. Who?
Freud.
Freud, right?
George Bernard Shaw.
Right. Who else?
Is Julian Huxley?
Well, could be, yeah. Looks like
D.
it.
D.H. Lawrence.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. That's right.
Fiery
Loins of Lawrence, obviously, knowing what he wrote about.
D.H. Lawrence.
Don't you know about D.H. Lawrence?
No.
No. Well, yeah. Lady Chatterley's Lover was the biggest. Wow. The biggest.
That was banned in the United States.
Well, they had a big Boston. Fight in. They had a big fight in England about it when it came out. And in the middle is the apotheosis of the common man. Now, how about the beautification of Saint Henna? Anybody know what that means? Reason for that is not because of your education, but because you're too young. Henna is the name that people is the term that was used for a red hair rinse when we were young. And if you henna'd your hair, wasn't that right? Henna.
Yeah, and you were usually a sort of a cheap person.
If you used henna on your hair, that was, you know, that was sort of like being a harlot. Well, not quite, but now. Notice also Saint Lukewarm of Laodicea, the Tolerator. Does anybody recognize that reference? Remember? Does anybody remember Revelation, the Book of Revelation? People of Laodicea, they were because you were lukewarm, I'll spew you out of my mouth.
Yeah.
So Saint Lukewarm of Laodicea, the Tolerator, see, because they were neither hot nor cold. You know, everything's okay. Everything's going to be all right. Then the apotheosis of the common man, commonly called lowbrow Sunday. Now you really have to be almost in an Anglican setup to appreciate that. Then Saint Mark's the Evangelist, All Fools Day, Venerable Bernard Shaw. The Sacred Name of Science, Fiery Loins of St. Lawrence, Smothering Sunday, which of course is
does very well in me. And Saint Sigmund Freud's subliminal, which is good. Theophany of the Spirit of Progress, commonly called Petrol Sunday. And the Gratification of Saint Gorge. And Blessed Lytton Strachey the Debunker. Lytton Strachey, of course, is one of a really interesting English writer who usually makes fun of absolutely everything, religion and the government and the people and everybody else included. All right, but that's it's kind of a neat little thing, and actually not that stupid to put in front of people to make them aware of the fact that that actually their gods are not what they mouth and say they are, but these are really the gods that determine how they're going to live. The next letter where Miss Dorothy L. Sayers, care of Mr. Punch, dear Dr. Sayers, and then this Didymus Pantheon, writes this long discussion on this window that they've discovered and explains it to her and says what a wonderful thing it is.
Could you see at the bottom of that page you have whose adherents are variously known as
Simon Stylites?
It looks like Anaman.
Where is this? Oh, here. Things. Oh, yeah. Well, you have to break them up into whose adherents are variously known as Stylites, Polarites, Anima Mundanes. Now, an anima is a spirit, and a mundane is a spirit of the world. See, worldly spirits. Anima Mundanes, Egregians. She just picked up a lot of names to make it sound really important. The Egregians would be people that like to get together. The cacophonophilists are the people that are always, you know, all the noise that goes in cacophony, you know, is always so awful to have to listen to. The Umbragians, which would be the people that are always taking, you know, when somebody takes umbrage, they're always feeling like you're hurting their feelings, or they're looking for reasons why they're being insulted. The Noli Me Tangerines, that I don't want anybody to touch me. That's what Noli Me Tangere means. Noli Me Tangere in Latin is, I will not you to touch me. And that means that, I'm sufficient unto myself and don't bother me. It's claimed that its following embraces almost the whole population of the Western world with the exception of a few strict Jews and fanatical Christian sects. And he just uses those words simply to give you a feeling of sort of to be impressed with the kind of people that are in the group. I think if you notice that these are all the pestilential season of umbrage is the one that comes after Trash Wednesday. Then comes the great equinoctial feast of the Enlightenment, whose season ends on Civilization Sunday. The season of compression, devoted to the celebration of the masses in urbanity, begins with Ignition Sunday and ends in explosion. Immediately after comes the Theophany of the Spirit of Progress, commonly called Petrol Sunday, which marks the summer solstice. After the brisk series of Sundays in Petrol, well, now you see, this is just a complete satire on what do we do with our year. You know, our year is actually determined by what kind of celebrations do we have, and what do we do with them. And she divides the polar year into the eight seasons, and you notice that the first season is the season of advertisement, a season of solemn preparation leading up to the birth of science, which is the winter solstice. Well, you know, for most people, Christmas is, if you're running a store, you've got to have a lot of commercial push from October to through December. And then you have the after Christmas sales. So really, for most people, this is a huge period of advertisement, and that's what she calls it. This is a season of advertisement, season of solemn preparation leading up to the birth of science, which is the winter solstice, followed by cacophony, which of course is New Year's Eve, which is, you know, that's when all the blaring and the trumpets and the hollering goes on and a lot of wildness, which extends from circumlocution to derogation day, after which Trash Wednesday brings us to the pestilential season of umbrage. This is page 5, by the way. And then the great equinoctial feast of the Enlightenment and so on. Break out into expansion, which lasts from bank holiday, and that's a common holiday in England. Those are these long weekends that they have to exhaust Sunday, and All Hallows, which we are going to soon celebrate at the end of October, you see, All Hallows Eve, and the Sunday following Polestar Sunday, which would be the beginning then of the new polar year. And you know, it's not so strange. It's really, I know what we noticed, particularly in prison camp, how really barren people are who do not live by a liturgical year, but have to live by the calendar year. If you don't have anything to celebrate, which you really didn't in prison camp, because there wasn't very much to celebrate, if the seasons of the year depended upon the calendar, you were really bereft. It was terrible. But if you lived according to the church year, it didn't really make that much difference, because you still celebrated things that didn't make any difference whether you had something to celebrate with, because the celebration of Advent and Christmas and Epiphany and Lent and Easter, all these things went around in their own cycle without the need of a calendar year to support it. And this is what she tries to get at here, is that you have to kind of think about the fact that sometimes you have to have it put in a satirical form to make you realize how far you've fallen from what was originally intended to be the life of man. Let's look at page 13. Now, first, I was going to have you look first at your table of contents. I didn't know how many of you had read the book or looked at it yet, but I want you to look at them. How many of you have ever read Adler's How to Read a Book? I don't expect you to have read it, because it was popular a long time ago. He's the man that worked with Robert Hutchins from the University of Chicago on the Great Books program, and Syntopticon, which we have down in the library, and had a lot to do with the eventual establishment of the center at Santa Barbara, although he isn't there. He's still in Chicago and works with the Encyclopedia Britannica on the lectures that they produce each year. But he wrote this book, How to Read a Book, and it's kind of a good thing to go over sometime if you can find one, because he said how few people ever look at the table of contents before they look at a book. And because they don't, they never know what's in the book. They just start reading and they don't know what the kind of the rhyme or reason of the book is. That's one thing that I did discover about reading a book after I read this. This was about, I wrote that 30 years ago, probably. But it does help to look at the table of contents, get an idea of what the different sections are on, kind of get an idea whether or not you have to read it in progression. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's, maybe all you want to do is read the last chapter. Why waste your time on a book if you're not old enough to read it, or you're too old to read it? Maybe it's not the kind of thing that you need to see. But especially when you're going to do something in a class, I think it's a good thing to read it, to look at the table of contents, because you do get a good feeling of what the kind of titles are, what the subject matter is, and how it progresses. And you'll notice that she moves from the shattering dogmas of the Christian tradition. And right away, when you get the word shattering dogmas, you realize that she's not going to talk about a kind of a taken-for-granted approach to Christianity, because she really believes that the teaching of Christianity is a shattering teaching. It's not a, you know, that's all right, kid, you'll make it approach. This is something that hits you square in the eye, and you're going to have to respond to it, or you fall down. That's all. It's not for babies. In other words, then the next one, the Bible and the Modern Reader, which is on biblical textual criticism, and particularly the one, well, both of them are good. The first one is excellent on how biblical criticism is, how it developed, and sort of an example of it. And then the next one is on, she takes one of Sherlock Holmes's mystery stories and shows what would we do if we treated it the way people treat the biblical texts, and actually made it make a textual study of, you know, what, how did he get the thing going? I mean, where does it come from? Now, does this really make sense? Can you say that this goes to this and this goes to this? And when you read it, you'll find that it's a really good satire on the continual use of textual criticism and how it's done. The next section on man is taken from The Mind of the Maker, and that's an attempt to understand how the creative person, the artist, is an analogy with a God who is the creator of that artist and of all art and of all that we have. And then the next one on the ethics of Christianity. Those are both excellent. And then the last one on the Christian imagination, which is a little more difficult. I don't know whether we'll just touch on it. I don't know whether you're really ready for that yet or not, because those are the kind of things that she wrote out of her own erudition and scholarship. And I don't want to scare you out, so I don't know that we'll go into that much of it. I do want you to look a little bit, though, at some of the things she says, just so you get an idea of her style before you start reading. Look at page 18. And she uses this little Latin, "Quibus sum grandium cresce et manducabis me." I am the food of the full grown, become a man and thou shalt feed on me. Now this is the principle that we operate with here at the village, and there are some people that can't take strong meat, and they don't take it, and so they just go through, you know, they go through their period at the village. And I'm talking about lifestyle, but I mean just in general, people come to the village and are on staff and they never take anything that's available to them, because they just, you know, they just want milk. That's all they want. They're just babies, and they want to stay babies. That's the tragedy of it. And you feel badly, because you feel like, you know, this is an adult place, and why come to an adult community if you don't want to eat adult food? But some people, you can't do it, and you can't push it on them. But this, the principle that Dorothy Sayers has in all of her writing on theology is that whatever you believe, doesn't make any difference whether you believe or disbelieve, you have to be willing to taste the strong meat of it and find out whether or not you like it or whether you can digest it or not, but not be afraid because you think it's too hard. If you look on the top of page 19, I think this is a really very good statement, which is, I've never seen any other place, that most, for many, many people, and this is, and you just think about some of the people that you know who are older than you are, and you'll see that it fits.
that most, and this is because of the fact that they've never grown into any kind of mature Christianity, a lot of them, their faith is not really in the future, but in the past. For many, many people, and this is, and you just think about some of the people that you know who are older than you are, and you'll see that it fits. That most, and this is because of the fact that they've never grown into any kind of mature Christianity, a lot of them, their faith is not really in the future, but in the past. Paradoxical as it may seem, to believe in youth is to look backward. To look forward, we must believe in age. Now that is a very contrary statement from what the kind of culture that the United States of America has. We are a youth-oriented culture and have been for years. I mean, we all want to look young, we all want to act young, and we all consider it a great compliment when people say, well, you don't look your age. Then on the middle of that page, the middle of the paragraph where she talks about becoming as little children, she talks about Peter Pan. How many of you know anything about, have you read Peter Pan? Anybody read Peter Pan?
No.
Well, in the child.
No.
Oh.
Really,
well, Peter Pan is a real book, by the way. It doesn't just come in the form of Disney.
Isn't it a play, though?
It was written by, J.M. Barrie. And he had a very, very fantastic idea when he wrote it. I've never agreed with it, but it was just about a boy that never wanted to grow up. And a lot of people think, oh, that's such a beautiful idea. That's a neat idea. You could just remain little kids. Anyway, she says, if he indeed exists otherwise than in the nostalgic imagination of an adult, is a case for the pathologist. All normal children, however much we discourage them, look forward to growing up, except you become as little children. And then she says, except you can wake up on your 50th birthday with the same forward-looking excitement and interest in life that you enjoyed when you were 5, you can't see the kingdom of God. Now just remember that this is a fact. You know, it's just so stupid because so many people just think that they don't really think of Christianity as being part of an actual way. This is something you really live with. This is just something that's up here. It's not actual. It's, you know, you don't really live with it. So, okay, if you wake up on your 50th birthday, you know, you shouldn't have to feel like you should be as a little child and there should be a lot of newness ahead of you. Then look over on page 21. How many of you have read anything by T.S. Eliot? What have you read?
I read some poetry of his and things. Oh, yeah. I don't remember what you
read. The quartets in the wasteland, part of the wasteland, maybe. Well, what do you read in high school now in English?
Well, I tried to read T.S. Eliot, but I thought it was boring.
Well, you have to take, I just wondered if you'd read them, that's all. I mean, a lot of people haven't read them, and I just wondered what they had in high school to...
I read the last chapter and put it away.
Well, of course, some of it's in prose, but some of it's in, a lot of it's in poetry. Did you say you read, did somebody over here say that?
Well, I've read just The Wasteland.
Yeah.
Part of it, of the collection of poems.
Yeah. Well, you're going to read them this year, I guess. Family Reunion is really an interesting play. We had they did the cocktail party up here for a drama one summer, and it's tremendous. It really is. Really, really good. Anyway, she refers to him here as in terms of the relationship that you have with time and with your family, with trying to deal with time, and how do you live with the problems of the age in which you're in, and she's got a very good quote here, but I don't think we're going to, since none of you have read it, I don't want to go. The next thing I want you to look at is on page 23. The bottom of the first paragraph, I hope you realize this is not to take the place of reading this book, because we're not doing it that well. I just wanted you to notice some of the things, the way she says it. The problem with, how a lot of people say, why do we have to bother with thinking about what are creeds, and what does this mean, and why do you have to break this down, and so on. And they say, away with the tedious complexities of dogma. Let us have the simple spirit of worship. Just worship, no matter what. And then, this whole business of being sincere. This is such a great deal. Or somebody up there likes me. Or all this kind of sentimental trash that is so popular because people are so sloppy about what they think. The only drawback to this demand for a generalized and undirected worship is the practical difficulty of arousing any sort of enthusiasm for the worship of nothing in particular. And you find that to be quite true. The way in which if you start talking to anybody about anything to do with the Christian faith, they will like to stay on generalities as much as possible, because then you can be agreeable. Nobody wants to argue and really get into a fight. Blake said that without contraries there is no progression, and we mentioned yesterday that Jesus said, I came not to bring peace but a sword, I came to cast fire on the earth, I came to bring division. And Carol always says that the gospel lives by controversy. So don't get the idea that where there's a nice, peaceful, sleepy appearance, that that's a really healthy congregation or a healthy group of people. The only place where there's likely to be health is where people are discussing and arguing with each other. If you can sleep over things, you're not thinking about them. And that's what has happened to most Americans with our vaunted intellectual literacy and so on, the fact that we're an educated country. And whoever argues about anything are so afraid of hurting somebody's feelings and thinking that because you disagree with somebody, that means that you don't like them anymore. And I don't want people not to like me. Well, you've got to, you have to realize that because you disagree with somebody does not mean that you don't like that person, or that you don't want to have anything more to do with that person. You can have real battles with them, and usually those are the people that you have the most respect for and that you have the greatest relationship with eventually. But if you can never talk to anybody about anything because you're so afraid that you're going to, maybe lose your face or image with them, then you're not respecting them or allowing the persons that you're speaking with to respect you, because you don't feel that the opinions that you have or the convictions you have are worth being shared, or that you can't share them with them because they wouldn't understand or something, Well, at once you either are snobby and patronizing or else you're afraid of them. You're not dealing with them as equals. Look on page 26, the middle, about the second, well, we can start at the top. We're chary of wielding the scourge of small cords, lest we should offend somebody or interfere with trade. We do not furbish up our wits to disentangle knotty questions about Sunday observance and tribute money, nor hasten to sit at the feet of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. Page 26, this is. We pass hastily over disquieting jests about making friends with the mammon of unrighteousness
and alarming observations about bringing not peace but a sword, nor do we distinguish ourselves by the graciousness with which we sit at meat with publicans and sinners. Somehow or other, and with the best intentions, we have shown the world the typical Christian in the likeness of a crashing and rather ill-natured boar. And this is the one that, this is the part that I think is important. And this in the name of one who assuredly never bored a soul in those 33 years during which he passed through the world like a flame. Let us in heaven's name drag out the divine drama from under the dreadful accumulation of slipshod thinking and trashy sentiment heaped upon it, and set it on an open stage to startle the world into some sort of vigorous reaction. If the pious are the first to be shocked, so much the worse for the pious. Others will pass into the kingdom of heaven before them. If all men are offended because of Christ, let them be offended. But where is the sense of their being offended? At something that is not Christ and is nothing like him. We do him singularly little honor by watering down his personality till it could not offend a fly. Surely it is not the business of the church to adapt Christ to men, but to adapt men to Christ. And this is what is so tiresome, I think, about generally, about the way in which we make Christianity into a lot of sugar pellets that are, you know, like aspergum or something. It's the dogma that is the drama, not beautiful phrases nor comforting sentiments, nor vague aspirations to loving kindness and uplift, nor the promise of something nice after death, but the terrifying assertion that the same God who made the world lived in the world and passed through the grave and gate of death. Show that to the heathen. They may not believe it, but at least they may realize that here is something that a man might be glad to believe. And that's why, I mean, it really gets you, because that's why we did Blake yesterday, and why we're concerned about Blake, because he really did smash into the stuffiness of the church, real just plain stuffiness, and even churches that have life in them get stuffy because they're so afraid that something might happen that's different from what they've done before, and somebody might. You know, how do you know they might lose their faith? As if God didn't love people and wasn't concerned about them. As if everything rested with us to be sure that protect the truth so that it doesn't get out into the cold and maybe shrivel up into nothing.
Well, what Martin Luther did was smash into all.
Yes,
that
Luther
sort
did
of
it
thing,
too.
And I love the way he talks.
Well, he did, but you see, the thing is that we're Lutherans, and so you see we can't do that too much because we're so tired of listening to Luther, because we learned him in the catechism. We'll get him during the year, but that's one reason why a lot of people, you know, never hear Luther, because they never read him. They never read him as
well.
Is.
I read him like it's brand new because I just discovered him.
Well,
myself.
That's right.
Know, I didn't have to go to
you didn't have
to. Sunday school.
Well, you're lucky. Because I think a lot of people, you know, would be lucky if they were converted as adults, because somehow when we get it as children, we never grow out of the kind of cream of wheat that we've gotten, you know, in Sunday school. And that's about where it's at. And, you know, our teeth never grow big enough to chew on anything else. This chapter on what do we believe is a good one, because she, as you can tell from the way in which she writes, she doesn't let you get off the hook. You have to deal with the actual tenets of your belief and say, you know, what do I really believe about this? And the other night, I don't know how many of you were here when on Sunday night when Ernie had his little Vespers on the Creed, which is really neat. But this is the next section is on the Creed, and it's very worth going into, because you realize what it is that you're saying or not saying, whichever you're not doing. At least you should know If you don't believe it, you should know why you don't believe it. Instead of, I don't believe it because it's a bunch of, you know, the people I know that believe it have never really thought about it. Or I know a lot of reasons why it isn't true. But a lot of people have never actually investigated what that creed is and beaten out for themselves whether or not it is true. You know, they've just said, well, I got to throw that out because scientifically it isn't so. There are a lot of other angles on it that, you know, you have to consider, and this is what Dorothy Sears is very good at. She's very careful about dealing with it from the point of view of the of a very muscular kind of intellect, not in any degree a sort of a baby baby-faced approach. Creed or Chaos is the name of a book that she wrote on the subject of the creed and why do we have a creed. A lot of people say, oh, I don't know why we should have a creed. You know, I believe, I really believe what I believe, but I think it's my business what I believe. And why should I have to believe what other people believe, or why do they have to share it with me? She's very clear on what is the reason for this and why we have to go about it. She uses an argument and a discussion with a man who disagrees with her, and it's good, but believe me, you're not dealing with a lot of what is meant by this is that you've memorized by heart. She puts it in very clear language, but it is language that you have to think about because it's well written. It's not simple. It's not journalistic. It's some of it's funny, some of it's ironic, some of it has a good quirk to it, but it's stuff that you've got to beat out with your heads. And this is Christianity is no place for lazy minds. In the middle of page 36, teachers and preachers never, I think, make it sufficiently clear that dogmas are not a set of arbitrary regulations invented a priori by a committee of theologians adjoining a bout of all-in dialectical wrestling. Most of them, that is, most of the creedal statements, were hammered out under pressure of urgent practical necessity to provide an answer to heresy. And heresy is, now this is what I want you to get, heresy is, as I have tried to show, largely the expression of opinion of the untutored average man trying to grapple with the problems of the universe at the point where they begin to interfere with his daily life and thought. Now you think about that. It makes a very big difference. This is another reason why it's important to know how to use language. Language is something that it has gone out of style, I think, in the average high school and I think in the average college too. I don't think most colleges do much with the use of language and understanding words and how to put sentences together in paragraphs. People say, oh, well, you know, we don't need it. We can look at TV, you know, and pretty soon we're going to have microfilm and everything's going to be taken care of. Well, I happen to think that it's important that your mind is still trained to use the things that are peculiarly unique to it. And there are few creatures on earth that use language. Very few. Think of them. Who else besides human beings? Unless you consider the way in which dolphins speak as language. But that is a trained thing, and all these different creatures who have certain kinds of expression, these are expressions of instinct, needs, but they are never expressions of abstract thought. They're never expressions of imagination. They're never expressions in which words are actually used to put thoughts into a coherent kind of connection. And just ask yourself, you know, how quickly do you want to quit being a human being? Just quit learning to use your mind and your language. You can soon quit being a human being by just sitting and looking at TV. She has a very good section, by the way, in her book on Creator Chaos on work, on the importance of work and the kind of work that Christians do just as part of society. And it's an excellent an excellent statement, I think. The next one, the next chapter is on the biblical criticism, which is really, really good. And then the fun one on Sherlock Holmes. And as I say, she in the section on Sherlock Holmes, that one, actually, there was a group of people that back and forth did this kind of thing. They tried to figure out the textual criticism of different works that had already been written, and they called it higher criticism. And and this particular one was the one that she did on one of these mystery stories. And of course, being a mystery writer herself, that was just duck soup for her. So I think you'll enjoy reading it just because it's a fun. It's a fun thing, and then she's got a little note on the end on Dr. Watson's handwriting. The next...
what's the point of the chapter?
Well, do you know anything about textual criticism, the biblical criticism? Well, see, the thing is, a lot of people were upset and in a great stew because they felt that the veracity of the Bible had been lost, because when they started to go through the text, they found that that the Bible wasn't all exactly as it had been, as we have received it. That there were some things that had been changed in it. There were some I's that had been dotted differently. There were some words that were out. There were some sections that were in some manuscripts were here and some manuscripts were there. And they said, "Wow, this isn't true. You know, how can we trust anything that comes out of this kind of junk, you know, all this messed up business?" And they went through a great deal of argument, and there was a lot of reaction on this. Actually, the amazing thing is that what textual criticism finally did was it proved a lot more than it sought to disprove, that the Bible and the Gospels, for example, have a lot more. They've been beaten around by everybody under the sun, people who didn't believe and people who did, and they still come out a very tough group of manuscripts with no essential truth out of them. There is nothing missing that is essential to what we need to know about the life and work of Jesus. And what these people did in England, because of the fact that they, as I say, they've had a different kind of education from ours. They've had classical backgrounds that we don't have, and they were able to sort of take off on this, and show how we could do this kind of thing with almost anything, and pull it apart and put it back together again. And you know, it's just really silly. Actually, I remember somebody saying that if they'd done the same thing with Virgil, and particularly with Homer, we'd never have anything left of it, if that was what we were concerned about. And what they discovered too is that the texts were, as I say, not that far off, and that the variations were not as great as everybody began, you know, shouted about at the beginning. When you read this, you'll find it's a very fun kind of a thing to do, because you realize you can take some things with a sense of humor. Almost everything can have some sense of humor, but but this particularly, which really gets you sort of nervous sometimes when some people take it too hard, and then she's able to really put it together in a really good way, I think. Her discussion on the disreputable ethics of Christianity is the one that follows the mind of the maker. I'll discuss the mind of the maker next week. That's quite a long section in here, and requires some thinking about. So you will have to read these, I think. And I wish when you do read them, if you'll you know, question it, put a check mark where you don't agree or where you have something you want to ask about. Be sure you put a mark in it so that we can take time with that, because we won't have, you know, otherwise we won't stop at everything, and we might get stopped at something and then have to skip over something else. So if there's something you want to ask about, be sure you underline it or mark down page. Christian morality section is very good, because it's sort of like Blake, actually. And I think you'll find that it's quite Blake and Dorothy Sayers agree pretty well. But she also has a very good discussion in the next chapter on the seven deadly sins. On page 136, she says, in the list of the seven deadly sins which the church officially recognizes, there is the sin which is sometimes called sloth and sometimes akkidi. And when you remember, I told you yesterday about akkidia, the problem that Blake understood as idleness, the thing that happens when you just no longer feel any kind of oomph to do anything. It does not mean, the one name is obscure to us, the other is a little misleading. It does not mean lack of hustle. It means the slow sapping of all the faculties by indifference. And, you know, this is what you know, Blake says it was an imaginative idleness that paralyzes the mind and just creeps all over the person. And by the sensation that life is pointless and meaningless and not worthwhile. It is, in fact, the very thing which has been called the disease of democracy. It is the child of covetousness and the parent of those other two sins which the church calls lust and gluttony. Covetousness breaks down the standards by which we assess our spiritual values and causes us to look for satisfactions in this world. The next step is the sloth of mind and body, the emptiness of heart, which destroys energy and purpose and issues in that general attitude to the universe which the interwar jazz musicians aptly named the blues.
What page are you on there?
136. It's the first paragraph.